Hello and welcome to episode 25 of the Thundercast. On today's show, we are discussing The Last of Us. I'm Matthew Sorey, and joining me today, I have Sean Kelly.
How you doing?
So, before we start the podcast in earnest, it's probably worth noting that we are going to be spoiling the shit out of The Last of Us. So, if you haven't played the game and you don't want it spoiled for yourself, then you have been warned. Okay, so we'll kick things off by talking about the story of the game, the setting and the characters and everything. So, this is a zombie apocalypse game. It's not advertised as such because the zombies in this game are never called zombies. They are called the infected. And they are created by a fungal infection spread by spores that turns people into madmen who want to eat each other, and eventually giant mushrooms who want to eat each other. So you play as Joel, who is a gruff middle-aged guy who has survived the outbreak for 20 years, and he's not that nice of a guy. So what did you think about the main protagonist in this game, Joel, Sean?
I thought that he was believable, most of all, which I think was something that Naughty Dog really had to nail with a new protagonist, because based on all the backlash, you know, each subsequent Uncharted game got, where in the first game was just like, no, I don't think anyone brought up ludonarrative dissonance about the first Uncharted game. They're just like, oh man, we're playing Indiana Jones, it's great. But then with each subsequent one, we're ramping up the action sequences more and more. And
yeah,
it's like, Nate Drake is, well, he's such a nice guy in those cutscenes, but then when you're controlling him, man, ruthless bastard.
He is incredibly murderous.
But Joel is established in the early, like, in the very beginning of the game, he's established as a nice guy, theoretically. You know, a good father, hopefully. But
yeah,
when you take control of him 20 years later, you can tell that, you know, those 20 years have not been kind to him.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that opening sequence, because at the very start of the game, you don't actually play as Joel. At the very first scene, you play as Joel's daughter,
Sarah.
Sarah, yeah, and you play the game from her perspective for a little while, whilst the outbreak is just happening, and you see Joel coping with the outbreak, and you have to run away from various zombie men as Sarah, and then eventually Joel when Sarah gets injured. And because we're talking about spoilers, we might as well just say that Sarah eventually gets shot by a policeman. Is he a policeman or is he a member of the army?
It's a military, like army.
Yes,
guy.
Some military type. So he shoots Sarah and she dies, and then it cuts to black, and then you start playing as Joel 20 years later. So I think you're right. I think when you first meet Joel, he is introduced as kind of a good guy. He's clearly working hard and supporting his daughter. It seems like he's a single dad. The fate of his wife really isn't talked about, or even if he had a wife.
Right.
And yeah, so he seems like a good guy, but when you join him 20 years later, it really seems like he's a bit of a broken man.
He's just totally a shell of a person.
Yeah, you can definitely tell the last 20 years has taken quite a toll, which is understandable, because there are crazy fungal zombie men in the world now. So society's kind of crumbled, and you take control of Joel, and you have to do some pretty shitty things, I thought, in the section after you play as Sarah. So it focuses quite heavily, after Sarah's section, on your relationship with a woman named Tess. And it seems like Joel and Tess are partners, although it doesn't really go into detail as to whether they are romantic partners or they're just survival partners. I kind of got the impression they were just survival partners myself.
Oh, I got the impression that they were both.
Did you?
I did.
I didn't really pick up on any hints, but I don't know. Maybe I wasn't searching hard enough.
I feel like there was an understanding between them, but that there was no real commitment to either party.
They just did it every now and then, but didn't talk about it.
They're post-infection fuck buddies, really.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's quite a good term, yeah. Yeah. So, what you're out to do when you first join up with Tess, you're trying to find someone who's basically screwed you over and taken some of your weapons, and you're out to find him and essentially murder him and find out where your weapons are. So that kind of sets the tone for this world. So this is a post-apocalyptic world, and everyone has turned into an absolute dickhead, as people do, or seem to do, in post-apocalyptic worlds in video games. So you do kill a lot of people in this game, like you've said, but I think you kill a lot of people in Uncharted as well, as Nathan Drake, but there's not really the same kind of dissonance here, because the world is set up as that kind of world in the first place. The rules of the world are established. It's kill or be killed, if you will. Survival of the fittest.
It's not only just the world has been established, but based on the fact that Joel and Tess have supposed, like, since the full 20 years that have passed aren't really fleshed out, you can only kind of grasp at what you assume they've been doing for 20 years, and you make the assumption that they've been these, you know, scavenging partners for such a long time that the body count that you amass in the time of The Last of Us versus the body count that the two of them have probably amassed in the last 20 years, probably pretty disproportionate.
He's probably killed quite a lot of people, I imagine, to survive. It's heavily hinted at. I mean, many times through the game, you are referred to as shitty people and having done bad things. There's a section later on in the game where Joel meets up with his brother, and there's lots of hints there that Joel did something terrible that his brother condemned and kind of disowned him for. But Joel obviously sees it as something that he did to survive the situation.
Right.
And Joel is very self-convinced in the fact that he is a survivor, and he does whatever he needs to do to survive.
Right.
I think there's definitely some kind of plausible reasons why he does act the way he acts, and that helps with the ludonarrative dissonance in this game, because yes, you do have to, well, no, you don't have to kill a lot of people, you can stealth around a lot of people, but it's inevitable that you will get in fights and you will have to kill people eventually in this game.
Yeah.
Okay, so the main crux of the story really comes when Joel meets a young girl called Ellie, and he eventually becomes her carer, and that's really the central relationship in this game, the way that Joel is kind of distant from Ellie to begin with, and then comes to care for Ellie. So what did you think about the relationship between Joel and Ellie and how that played out?
I thought what made it work was the way that they slowly revealed Ellie as a character. Like, she is similar to Joel in that when she shows up in the game, she's also sort of like a shell that you don't really know anything about. And the difference is that her shell is that since she's considerably younger than Joel, she has only lived during this post-infection world. Yeah. And when she first gets out of that first quarantine zone in Boston and starts seeing, you know, the world at large outside of it,
yeah,
like her character starts to reveal itself, and you get that wonderful juxtaposition of Joel, who has been throughout the world and seen it how it used to be and how it was intended to be, and how Ellie is experiencing this all, and also you get those great moments of like little tiny sprinkles of humor where she's like, oh man, teenage girls, you know, back in the day, they had to worry about what boys to date and what to wear or whatever. Like,
yeah,
things that are so completely irrelevant in their current world.
I thought that was a really nice touch, the way that Joel and Ellie just have random little conversations where Joel has to explain what the world was like beforehand, because she, as you say, has never experienced it. She wasn't alive before this fungal outbreak. And there's a lovely one when they get to a university, and Joel's trying to explain what a university is and how it's where people go to find themselves. And she can't really understand that concept.
Yeah.
Because it's something she's never had the luxury of.
Right.
Yeah, so very nice relationship between Joel and Ellie. I think it's very nice as well the way that you see Joel's affection for Ellie develop over the game. I mean, I would say for the first half of the time that you spend with Ellie as Joel, he's kind of distant to her, and he's trying to get her to a point where he can get rid of her. And it's pretty clear that Joel is a very, very closed off character. Largely, I imagined myself, because of what happened in that opening sequence with Sarah. And I think Naughty Dog did a really good job of making you understand why Joel is that closed off shell of a character in the first half. And there's a point where you get to meet up with Joel's brother, and Joel tries to get rid of Ellie on Joel's brother. And Ellie is kind of so upset by that, because as she says, Joel is pretty much the only constant that she's ever had in her life. Everyone else has left her. People have either died or they've just left her for different reasons. But Joel was the one person that she wanted to be the constant in her life, and Joel's pushing her away because of what happened to his own daughter, Sarah, and he's never been able to make those relationship, that kind of relationship again. Because in this world, he, as he sees it, that kind of relationship gets you killed. And I thought this kind of... There's a turning point in the middle of, well, middle towards the end of the game, where Joel tries to push her away, but then he comes around and he really starts to act as her protector and care for her. You see that he's finally opened up, and she becomes the thing in this world that is keeping him alive, his reason for being, if you will. So in some sense, this story was kind of about Joel as a character, why he'd closed up to begin with, and why he was then opening himself up, how Ellie had opened him up and made him care in this world again, which was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think there's also part of the change that he goes through is after Tess's death in the first third of the game, I feel like he carries on the journey of taking Ellie to her destination out of a sense of duty and respect to Tess. And I think that's a lot of where I feel like they did have a long-standing relationship that was more than just a, you know, partnership. And there is that sort of realization that he finally gets to when he meets up with his brother that, you know, he isn't just taking Ellie out of a sense of duty, that he, you know, has developed some sort of fondness for her and found a feeling that he hadn't felt, you know, since before the outbreak.
For 20 years, possibly, or more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like Naughty Dog did a really good job of keeping that distance between the characters, and it never felt like there was just like a light switch that Joel was like, oh, well, now I'm your surrogate father. Character is just like,
yeah. No, it was definitely something that developed over a long time in the story, and that kind of pacing felt really natural. As you say, it didn't feel like a light switch. So let's talk about some of the other side characters, if you will. There's a character called Bill, who is Joel's friend, it seems, from sometime in those 20 years, someone that he's come across and knows and apparently owes him a favour. I think Bill was quite an interesting character because he really is that kind of expression of the idea that you can't care for anything in this world. You literally have to look out for yourself. There's kind of an interesting story about Bill, about how Bill used to have this best friend that he survived in this world with, but they fell out and they came to hate each other, but kind of still depend upon each other. And if you actually search around some of the buildings where Bill lives and has very defended from the zombies, you can pick up some notes that kind of explain the backstory between Bill and his friend character. Did you come across those, Sean?
I found a bunch of them, so yeah, probably read the same ones. I thought it was an interesting way that they tied Bill's story with, I can't remember what his partner's character's name was at all now.
Nah, I can't remember either. Let's just call him Frank.
Frank or Frank?
Whatever you want. Frank, if you want.
But yeah, he, along with some of the other characters I meet later in the game, I feel like they did an excellent job of showing all the different type of personalities that manifest themselves during this sort of, you know, global chaos.
Yes, because you get Joel saying a lot that in this world You can't care for people. You need to look after yourself and survive. And Bill, as I said, is the ultimate expression of that. And he's kind of a crazy, crazy character. He just doesn't seem to care about anyone apart from himself. And he is the ultimate shell of a man. He's not even as open as Joel, who is very shelled up emotionally. So he's quite interesting. So two other characters that you meet along your journey as Joel are Henry and Sam. And I thought they were quite a nice parallel to draw against Joel and Ellie. They're kind of in the same situation where you have the older, not patriarch because they are brothers, but you have the older guy who is really taking charge of things and caring for this younger person. Henry's the older guy, Sam is his younger brother. And what happens to them? So Sam gets bitten, turns, attacks Ellie, and Henry has to shoot him in the head. That is obviously too much for Henry to take, and he kills himself. That again is really another kind of expression of what this world does to people. In a world where you could turn at any moment from a fungal infection, and you could, as Henry, you could just lose someone like that. That it would drive him to suicide straight away. Did you think they're interesting characters, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were interesting characters, and I thought their parallel of this, since they had a similar dynamic, was useful to show that there were other people in the world, like, going through the same things, and they were also part of a group that had been, you know, separated and presumed dead. In some ways, I don't feel like the end of their story really had much of an effect on me or the game itself. And I feel like that has more to do with even if it's not, you know, quite a zombie game, it's still working with the same basic, you know, narrative plot devices.
Same plot devices
that any other zombie story will tell. And, you know, there's always going to be someone that gets bitten. There's always going to be someone that gets bitten and has a family member, and yeah. Those never end up going well. And the tone of the world was already established to be this place where it is kill or be killed. And I thought it was just kind of like beating a dead horse, but it didn't really. I didn't think it was underhanded or anything like that. But I did like the time that I spent with those characters a lot.
Yeah. It was interesting to see other characters that had a similar dynamic to Joel and Ellie in this world. Because you do spend a lot of time around people who are trying to kill you. So it's quite interesting to see that there are still people in the world who are like you. Later on from that, I think there is one of the most interesting scenes in the game, and really took me by surprise somewhat, in a really, really good way. It's the part where you go to the university, you're trying to find this group called the Fireflies, because that's where you're trying to get Ellie to, and Joel ends up falling off a ledge and impaling himself. Kind of Lara Croft style in the most recent Tomb Raider.
Yeah, I was like, well, somebody saw the E3 presentation from 2 years ago.
That looks cool. Well, at least they didn't make a QTE out of it. That's a positive. But yeah, that really took me by surprise. It didn't seem to be setting up the situation where Joel was going to hurt himself. It just happened. I don't know if you felt like that. It really just took me from left field.
Yeah, I guess I should. I afterwards, I didn't feel like I should be as surprised, since the game establishes from the very beginning that control can be taken away from Joel. And I mean, I guess I didn't know where the game was going at that point, because you had reached what was supposed to be your destination and not found what you were looking for. I don't know. Did you think Joel was dead?
I kind of wished he was. So yeah, Joel impales himself. He gets off, and Ellie manages to. She doesn't carry him out, but she guides him out, and you get away. And the game cuts to black. And when it opens up again, it's winter, and you are playing as Ellie. So the implication there, or you could infer from that, that Joel is dead. And I thought that would have been a really brilliant move on Naughty Dog's behalf to take the control away from Joel, and just to focus on how Ellie then copes with the situation without Joel. I thought that would have been really, really interesting. And I love that whole sequence where she's hunting in the forest, where you're hunting the deer. I thought that was really well done, and it's really like it's a really quiet, calm moment just after this crazy moment where something completely unexpected's happened.
Yeah.
So yeah, I kind of hoped he was dead, which I don't know if that's a good thing. I thought the game would have been very interesting if they had done that. They don't do that. It turns out he's alive. But the whole sequence where you are playing as Ellie and Joel isn't there is probably, I don't know, it's probably my favourite sequence in the game. I thought that was really, really well done. You end up coming across this guy named David, who is super creepy. And it turns out, eventually, through conversations you have with David, that he is the leader of the group of people that you have been murdering for the previous few sections of the game. You've been killing a lot of people in the previous few sections of the game, and it turns out he was their leader. And the way he goes about telling you, you go through a situation where you have to survive a zombie attack with David, so you kind of don't trust him, I would say, but you have to survive with each other. You have to pair up and fight off this zombie attack together. And then you sit down next to a fire. Ellie and David sit down next to a fire, and they're just having a casual conversation. And then he comes out with a line, "Well, I believe that everything happens for a reason." And there's a lovely piece of music where there's a little chime that comes in, and he goes on a speech about how he is the leader of these people. And it's just a really creepy, unsettling moment that I wasn't really expecting.
Yeah, I had no idea where that scene was going, and that is a place where the story just turned on a dime, and it was a really, really good reveal.
Yeah. I think after you've just seen what happened to Joel and that being so unexpected, you're kind of in that mindset where you feel like the story could go anywhere. And having such a creepy scene it really felt unpredictable at that point.
Well, that's the thing, is like when you don't know at that point whether Joel is dead or not, I don't know that I wish he had died at that point, because even though the game is about their relationship, I think the game is about his story. Mm. And if his story just dies, if his story ends with his death there is no closure for it. And maybe that makes sense in this world, that, you know, you don't have the opportunity to finish whatever your story is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, you are right. Come the end of the game, this is definitely Joel's story. You see Joel. So should we go into the ending? Do you want to talk about the ending?
Yeah, we can talk about whatever.
Okay, so
talk about everything else, basically.
Yeah. You know the story of The Last of Us now. So yes, the ending, you do finally Ellie gets captured by David, and he's kind of a crazy person. You see him chopping some people up. Oh, was that David or was that someone else? But whatever. In David's survivor camp, you see them chopping people up, and it's implied that they eat people. They eat them for meat. Kind of similar to what The Walking Dead, I believe it was episode 2, did. Yes, you're still playing as Ellie at this point. You manage to escape from David, and it sets up this whole kind of boss fight kind of scenario where David is chasing you around a diner. You're playing as Ellie, and you have to kill him, essentially, to get out. He's gone crazy, and he's trying to kill you. Meanwhile, while all this is happening, Joel has finally woken up, and he manages to capture two people from David's camp, and he tortures them. And that scene where Joel is torturing these people is absolutely brutal. It's horrible. And it, again, just reinforces that idea that you're not actually playing as someone who's... He's not a nice person. He's not a good person. He's a person who's very willing to do the most brutal things in the world to look after those that he cares about. In this case, being Ellie. That person being Ellie. Yeah. Ellie is fighting off David in this diner area, and I thought it was a really interesting narrative decision on Naughty Dog's part to have Ellie actually kill David before Joel gets there. Joel doesn't get there and save her. She saves herself, essentially. And she was a really well-written, strong female character in that sense, because usually I would imagine, or I would have expected the situation to go that Joel turned up and saved her. But that definitely wasn't the case. That was quite interesting. So from there, Joel goes on to take Ellie to the Fireflies. They learn where the Fireflies now are. And the Fireflies want to operate on Ellie because Ellie... We haven't mentioned this, actually. Ellie is... Ellie herself carries the... Not the cure, but potentially a vaccination to the infection,
she's
because she has been
it,
bitten. Yeah, she's immune to it, yeah. She's been bitten and she hasn't turned. So that's why Ellie really is this important character in this world. And the Fireflies want to operate on her brain, extract the fungal spores from around her brain, and reverse engineer a vaccine to the fungus. And before they can operate, Joel ends up murdering quite a lot of them and taking Ellie away from them. Not allowing them to extract this vaccine. So the decision that Joel has at this point is to let them operate on Ellie, kill Ellie, and potentially save thousands, possibly millions of lives. I'm not entirely sure how many people are still alive in this world. But he doesn't do that because he needs Ellie now. He's come to care for Ellie, as we talked about. So he takes her away. And the very final scene of the game, which I thought was super interesting and very different for a video game, was Ellie asking Joel whether... Oh, sorry. No, I should set this up. As
Joel
Ellie
tells
as
her,
Joel is telling. Yeah, got
Joel
you,
tells
you tell
her that
Joel.
There are... That the Fireflies told him that there were other immune people that they also found and they didn't need her.
Yeah,
so that she
yeah.
wasn't the single hope for humanity, that she was one of many, and that she therefore did not need to sacrifice herself for the cause. And
so basically the final scene is Ellie asking Joel if he lied about that, and he says no. Lies to her again, and makes her think that he wasn't lying. So I thought there was a lot of subtext in that final scene. I think Ellie kind of knows that Joel is lying at that point. She can see it in his eyes.
That's
the
way
I
feel about it, that she does know. It was interesting.
Yeah.
They, in the past week, one of the people from Naughty Dog said that that was not how it ended previously. That
right.
They had it definitely seem like that Ellie was oblivious to the lie and not like complicit in it. But I do feel like she is established as a savvy enough character that she understands what her standing is with Joel and what that needs to be for him.
Yeah, and I think by this point you can tell that she understands what he is and who he is and how he's now come to depend on her. It's not the other way around. He
exactly.
is depending on her for survival. She's not depending upon him. And I think that was one of the themes in the game that was very interesting. Emotionally, he needed her to survive. Okay, so we've prattled on there for quite a while about the story in this game, which I think really speaks to how interesting the story is and how different it is for a video game. It's not the typical video game story. It takes a lot of the common tropes that you might find in other post-apocalyptic video games, but it really is a lot more subtle and a lot more intricate, and it has a lot of themes going on underneath that post-apocalyptic surface. That are a lot more interesting than you would commonly find in video games. Okay, so we'll take a short break there, and then we'll come back and talk about the gameplay. So we've talked a lot about the story in this game. So let's talk now about the gameplay. This is a third-person action adventure game, very much in the vein of the Uncharted games that Naughty Dog has previously made on the PS3. But I would say it's linear, but it felt a lot more open at times in terms of the width of the world that you had to travel through. And stealth genuinely felt like a viable option most of the way through the game, which I thought was a very interesting thing for Naughty Dog to do, because that would make sense in the context of this game. You wouldn't want to enter many confrontations. You would want to avoid them wherever possible, I felt. So what did you feel about the gameplay, Sean? Did you feel that it was fun? Did you feel that it fit the story? I don't really feel like the purpose of it necessarily was to be fun, but...
I actually really loved the gameplay. And what I really loved about it was I thought that it did a better job than most games of marrying stealth and action. And what I mean by that is, in a lot of games that either claim to be stealth games or games that really are designed to be played in more of a stealth fashion, like your Deus Ex games or Dishonored. I often feel like you start every encounter in stealth because that's the way, at least I personally feel that I should play, and that's the way that I want to play. And then when that moment, when I screw up and I've alerted guards and you get into that action confrontation, I always feel compelled to restart the area. Because I feel that I've failed my personal objective. And
you feel like you've done it wrong, like it's not designed to be played in the action style.
Yeah, and I know that that's partially my own thing that I need to get over, but there's the thing about combat in The Last of Us that when you're found, the transition from stealth to combat feels so seamless and natural in that game. The game actually has a restart checkpoint or restart conflict option in the menus or something. So if you wanted to stealth the entire game, I think you viably could do that with that option. But I never once reset an area because I was found. Like I always found it very interesting. I think it helps because it is a survival, like a quote-unquote survival game that, I wanted to see if I could survive this conflict, if I could find the things I needed in the area, if I could find that brick that I needed to slam in someone's face.
So many perfectly formed red bricks lying around.
The entire time when I was playing that game, I was imagining the starting sentence of my review being something about being like the best like post-apocalypse bricklayer ever. I kid you not, I think I wandered around 90% of that game with a brick in hand. Like if I didn't have a brick, like I didn't feel safe. Like a brick was more useful to me than like ammunition or anything.
Bricks are super useful in this game. Used for distractions, used to bash people over the head. Amazing. Yeah, so I think I felt the same way about it, really. It felt very natural, that transition from stealth to action. It didn't feel like there were pre-prescribed sections where the game was telling you, look, you're in stealth mode now, avoid these guys or else you fail. Every encounter kind of leaves it up to you, because there are lots of chest-high things in this world, and Joel is obviously got really strong butt muscles, because he's very good at crouching and sneaking around, kind of in a solid snake style. It kind of leaves the decision as to whether you actually confront people in the game up to you, or whether you avoid them, which, as I said before, it felt very natural. It felt like that's what if you were actually living this in the real world, if you were actually doing this yourself, that's what that situation would be like. You would try to hide initially, and you would try to sneak past people, but if you messed that up, then you would have to deal with the confrontation. And I was the same as you. I never felt a need to actually restart any of the encounters because I thought that I'd done them wrong. I just played everything out to its eventual conclusion. Yeah. Okay, so obviously you've got Ellie with you and other partners for quite large portions of the game. And they can interact somewhat in the combat. they are kept relatively safe to a certain extent. You will see a lot of situations where Ellie will run out in front of the bad guys to get to you because you're behind cover, and they will completely ignore her because clearly their AI is programmed in such a way where they focus on you.
Well, that's only, I would only say that's true if you're still in a stealth, if you're still not alerted to guards. They pay attention to her once they're aware of you also.
Yeah. And I kind of found myself wishing that they'd gone the Resident Evil 4 route in a way. Where
so made her a helpless female?
No. I don't mean that. I kind of felt like I kind of wish they'd gone one way or the other way. She really was implemented within gameplay, so she quite often got in a situation where she was in trouble, or that she really had to help you. She could help you get out of that situation. I didn't feel like I got in many of those situations throughout the game. It kind of felt like she was the passive observer in gameplay. Even though she wasn't, she does interact, but it didn't feel like she was doing it very much.
Yeah, I felt like she mostly was a non-entity, and I think my stats say I think I had two partner deaths the entire game.
Right.
And I don't think that I want them to go the full opposite direction where, you know, every other conflict you have to pry a clicker off her or, you know, say, I don't want it to be like Aiko where she's being dragged off like every 5 seconds or whatever. But
yeah,
it did really kill moments where I'm hiding in the dark and she's running in front of a clicker and it, it apparently here, you know, the only way it finds things is by echolocation somehow.
And she's shouting at you, it's over there.
So I think there had, I mean, I've seen people argue that, oh, well, you know, AI isn't at this point yet where you can, and I'm like, I don't buy that. I think they decided that this was the best way to do it, you know, given the situation. And
I think it was a conscious decision on the behalf of the designers to alleviate frustrations. Because as you say, if they had that kind of ICO setup where your partner character, whoever it was constantly being carried off by people, I think they would have interpreted that as being frustrating, the designers.
Well, one, it would be frustrating, but two, if you repeatedly put Ellie in that situation, then you're not making her Joel's equal anymore.
No, that's
true. You're making her a damsel in distress over and over again. And there are points in the game where she is a damsel in distress, but, you know, there's also the point in the game where Joel is
a damsel in distress.
Yeah, if you want. I don't know what the equivalent to damsel for male is.
Yeah, we need to figure it out, don't we? I don't know. Man in need. <Doesn't really.
laughs> Has to be an alliteration.
Yeah. I can't think of one.
So what do you think about the... Actually, what difficulty did you play the game on?
Normal.
Normal, okay. We both played on normal. Did you find that there was a glut of supplies by the end of the game?
You can only carry so much of every certain thing, can't you?
Yes.
Yeah. I did find that I was maxing the limits of some of them, like my ammunition and things, at some points, because I generally tried to avoid most conflict situations. So I ended up with a lot of resources by the end of the game, I would say. But there were definitely plenty of times in the game where I would want to use my gun in a certain situation, but I had run out of bullets, which I really quite liked. Those situations really enforce the idea of what this world is, that resources should be scarce and you shouldn't feel too powerful, if you will.
Right.
How about you?
I felt like in the first, I felt like the first half of the game was a lot more challenging than the second half of the game, and I found that as I got more comfortable in the world, that I felt like I knew how to navigate combat a lot better, and I found myself using
Yeah.
less and less resources. So,
Yeah.
I don't know if necessarily there are more resources towards the end of the game, but I always felt like I had more than enough tools by the end of the game to do what I needed to do. And I think I don't know if this is a conscious design decision of theirs. I feel like it probably was. But I feel like the game has a really interesting inverse difficulty curve that I felt that the very beginning of the game is extremely challenging because you don't really understand how the clickers react. I mean, I died a few times against human enemies, but I would say that most of my early deaths were just, oh shit, I just alerted this clicker and then insta-death, basically. But I feel like this difficulty curve of where it's really challenging in the beginning is kind of mirroring what any survivor would go through in this world, and also what Ellie herself is going through coming outside of the quarantine zone, is that you are learning to be a survivor in this world, and as you get to that point where you're becoming more and more like Joel because you're learning to like be ruthlessly efficient at dispatching these people as you need to, that the game becomes more easier and killing these people becomes more easier. And you're also conditioned to not feel like for the first hour when you smash those bricks into people's faces, like it really does. I mean, it is unsettling. It's unsettling, like that scene later with the torture and But by the time, like I don't think that torture scene really affected me because I was so conditioned by the game to be like, this is just how this world works. Like it's terrible.
Because you'd killed people in so many different ways with that red brick. By that point,
it's so useful. It has six sides of death.
Was it six corners? Was it? Oh god, it wasn't the same brick, was it? Can you pick a brick up after you've thrown it?
No, it splits into two no matter what you do with it.
Okay. I was going to say you didn't have a pet brick throughout the entire
game. But I mean, I should be able to pick both pieces up and then have two half bricks.
Oh man, that'll be next generation.
And you
generation
know, like,
design.
The thing was, like, even though, because in addition to bricks, you also have the bottles, glass bottles, which you could use. They actually effectively are the same object because they have the exact same effect when you use them. But I would specifically go out of my way if I had a glass bottle and I saw a brick, I would trade them. Because I'm like, this glass bottle is not going to fucking kill somebody, but that brick, let me tell you.
Brick is lethal. Brilliant. Okay. So, what did you think of the crafting in this game? Because we've talked about resources and the scarcity of resources through the game. So you can pick lots of things up. You can pick scissors up and tape, and there's lots of like base resources that you can craft into useful items like health packs and bombs, like mines, if you will, that you can lay. So what do you think about the design of that system?
Well, getting past the inherent silliness of finding, like, a third of a bandage or, like, half a scissor.
Yes! Yeah, you can find quarter of a scissor, which I didn't really understand, but that's great.
Video
games!
I have to say that, in general, I loathe crafting in games. I don't know that I've played a whole lot of games where I've had to do a lot of crafting, but I only crafted in Skyrim to game the game, to like gain experience points. I only crafted in Dead Space because I was reviewing the game and I felt like I should understand how the system worked. But I feel like crafting works so well in Last of Us because it is absolutely an essential thing to do and it's so easy to do. Like, you open your menu, and it shows you exactly what you need to do, and I love that there is no pause when you do it. Like, the menu is live, so you have to do it on the fly, and it's something they translate to multiplayer, which I think is great there also. And the other thing that... I think what I don't like about crafting in other games is there's always that moment where it's like, well, what are these two objects going to yield? What am I wasting these things making nothing? Like, I don't know what it's going to yield, but you know what everything is going to be yielded in The Last of Us, and everything is useful. So it's just a natural extension of an inventory system.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a particularly difficult system to get your head around. It gives you all the instructions you need to figure out if you've got enough to craft a certain item, and what that item will do when you make it. But I think it was a neat little system that made sense within the context of the world. If you were a survivor, you would figure out how to make bombs from a quarter of a scissor, a plaster, and a bag of sugar. Because that's clearly a useful skill to have in that world. And those items that you could craft, they were kind of like sort of like the power weapons in the game, if you will. They really gave you an advantage over any confrontational situation that you came across.
Right.
So I really enjoyed crafting as a system. I kind of wished it was a little deeper in some way, but that's probably because I'm not as you, and I enjoy crafting systems in games generally.
I felt that it was pretty deep, actually.
Okay.
The way that I don't feel... Okay, let me explain how I thought it was deep. It's established immediately with the crafting system that, like, let's look at it this way. A med kit or a Molotov cocktail, they both require the exact same things to make.
About one, I think. I can't remember what item it was, but I think it requires three items. Yeah, yeah.
More or less same thing. So it's, do you want the benefit of having a health pack, which is something that you are absolutely going to need at some point? Or do you want the benefit of, as you said, a power weapon? Or do you want to craft this shit, or do you want to use this shiv to instant kill a clicker? Or do you want to use this shiv to open a door?
Yeah.
I thought that they did a really smart job by creating this risk reward mechanic in do I want to use this for a necessity or for a bonus, essentially.
Yeah. So it's a system that really opens up a lot of choices about how you play the game.
Right.
So you could use the system very differently to someone else. You could purely just craft shivs to open those doors and get all the bonuses behind those doors. Or you could be, if you're a very aggressive player, then you can craft a hell of a lot of Molotov cocktails. And maybe you won't need as many health kits.
I felt that was also how the game itself worked, because when you made that choice to avoid certain combat sections, you were also saying, all right, there's probably a shiv door or some sort of collectibles in this area that if I am going to stealth through here, I'm never going to find. Because the reality is that if you're looking for those triangles floating on top of a dresser drawers, you're probably going to get killed from behind unless you clear that room.
I would say it felt the way that you played the game felt very appropriate in the context of the story. You take control of the game in those combat situations, and the way that those combat situations played out, I thought there's clearly a lot of intelligent decisions gone into how Naughty Dog have designed the game's systems to make it feel like you are in that world. It didn't feel so much like a game at times in the way that an Uncharted game does. In Uncharted, you have the cutscene, and then when you play the game, you're very much aware that you are playing a game. It's kind of like, this is the story section, this is the game section. But in The Last of Us, I thought that the story and the gameplay blended together much better than they do in something like Uncharted. It felt like one cohesive world, and you directed Joel and Ellie and whoever else you were playing through the confrontational scenarios and combat systems, and then you were told a story as well, which I thought worked really well.
Yeah, I think they work. I think the gameplay and the narrative and cinematics work better in this game because I feel like there is actually a stake involved in the game. Where, I mean, you do have that moment later in the game where it's like, oh shit, is Joel dead or not? Like, that's something that's plausible in this world that they've established. Whereas, really, the only thing you're waiting for in Uncharted story-wise is the moment that Elena and Nathan Drake reconnect. Like, it's just friends, but with guns.
Yeah.
You're just waiting for Rachel and Ross to come back together. You know it's going to happen, you just don't know when.
Yeah, you never get that. You never really have a sense of danger.
Exactly.
Or consequence in the world. You never think that any of these scenarios that they're setting up that could potentially be dangerous, you know that they're not going to end in a death. It's like Man of Steel. new Superman film has just come out. You know that Superman isn't going to die at the end of this because it's a big studio production and they're going to want to make more if it makes a lot of money. So you never really have a sense of danger, a sense of potential, I don't know, consequence from the scenarios that you've been putting that you're supposed to be affected by. And The Last of Us really felt like there could be consequences from these dangerous scenarios you were putting. In a way that many other entertainment products, films, games, things like that, often don't.
Before we move on from gameplay,
mm-hmm.
What did you think about swimming? Swimming making a return to video games.
I thought that was sensational. I absolutely loved the swimming. It's my favourite part of the game, possibly. More so than the brick play.
So you actually like swimming more than carrying ladders?
Yeah, we should note that it wasn't just all combat situations. There were a few sections where you have to move object one from point A to point B to progress. And sometimes that object was a ladder. And other times, that object was Ellie on a raft whilst you were swimming in water. It kind of felt like Naughty Dog's technical team had gone out of their way to figure out how they could make the swimming super cool and realistic. I mean, I think they had swimming in Uncharted 3, didn't they? I don't think you ever go underwater.
You
couldn't go underwater, yeah. So it kind of felt like Naughty Dog's technical team, the engine team, had figured out how to make swimming realistic. So the design team's like, well, God, we've got to get this in there everywhere we possibly can, you know? Post-apocalyptic world, there'll be water everywhere. Water in all of these buildings, and the bottom floor will be flooded. God, you're going to have to swim everywhere. So those situations, yeah, I get it. You have to move ladders sometimes in post-apocalyptic worlds, and Ellie can go on the raft because she's lighter than Joel, and Joel can swim. Yeah, that's cool. It kind of got a bit tedious, to be honest with you. It kind of felt like physics puzzles in Half-Life 2, the seesaw puzzle that was used over and over again.
I feel like Half-Life 2 was far more egregious. Look what we could do.
Yeah, that's it. That sums it up. It's look what we could do from a technical perspective.
I remember the first time I played that, and I picked up a cinder block, and I put it on like a slide in the beginning of City 7 to watch it like fall down. And
oh,
I was
my
like, what?
Yeah. It's pretty cool the first time you see it, but the 17th time, it's kind of like, yeah, we get it. We know
actually,
you can do this.
I actually really like the environmental puzzles in Last of Us.
I like them from a pacing perspective. I think they added some quieter moments where you got some nice conversations between Joel and Ellie, and I think they really brought something to the table in that respect.
Right. When I first started the game, I realized how little I had known about it. Like, I didn't... Because I really expected it to be those sequences they'd shown at E3 of, you know, trying to survive these, you know, bandits or whatever, interspersed with follow the Yellow Brick Road style Uncharted platforming.
Yeah.
Which there is absolutely none of, which is what I really expected. And, I like that the environmental puzzles were their solution, that because it gave you... The Last of Us doesn't really have any of those like bombastic set pieces like an Uncharted game, but it has those moments where there's a train station that's... It's not supposed to be Grand Central Terminal, because I don't remember what city you're in at the time. You might be in Pittsburgh, I think, but it's, you know, it's a grand old like train station, and... And you do have to find your way around it, and I thought that was, in addition to like the pacing you said, but it was a great moment to actually allow you to explore, and those were the moments that Ellie would be like, oh, what was this place like before everything went to shit? And
yeah,
they gave you a way to remain engaged in the world while you were, you know, looking for where to drop the ladder or, you know, where to find the ladder or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely always felt throughout the game, it always felt like they use every possible point in the game when you're playing to bring something up, to develop Joel and Ellie's character just a little bit more, to have a little conversation that maybe tells you something about why she is the way she is or why he is the way that he is. So I think they really cleverly utilize the downtime in this game in terms of gameplay. Yes. Okay, so just before we take a break, there's another moment in the game that I want to talk about that we haven't really touched on yet. And you'll know what I mean when I say giraffes, Sean.
Monkeys also.
Monkeys and giraffes, yeah. I thought that was such a lovely moment in the game, and it was so unexpected. I hadn't spoiled anything about this game for myself before I played it. And so, just to set it up for people who are listening, there's a moment in the game when you enter a city just by yourself, just Joel and Ellie by yourselves. You've just been through all these hardships. This is actually after the winter section, which we talked about in the first part of this podcast. And the winter section's horrible, but then Joel and Ellie are back together. It's spring, and everything's looking up, and you enter this city, and there are giraffes roaming about in the centre of the city, and you can actually go and pet the giraffe for a while. And it's just such a lovely, kind of surreal moment in the game that reminds you that nature is out there and not caring, because you're so engrossed in this human story of human survival. And it just felt so different. What did you think of the giraffe moment, Sean?
It was very unexpected, yeah. And I think in some ways it's kind of cheesy, but I kind of love it anyway. Like,
yeah,
life goes on.
Right,
like, even as humanity is tearing itself apart, like, I had the little Ian Malcolm on my shoulder that says, life found a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of felt a little bit Terrence Malick to me. Have you ever seen any Terrence Malick films?
I have seen a few of them in my day.
Yeah, so it kind of felt like a Terrence Malick thing to do, where he would be filming like people having an argument, and then he'd just slowly turn his camera away and film a snail on the floor just to remind you that
nature's
there. Extreme close-up
of like a plastic bag.
Nature's over there, not giving a shit about what humans are doing. Yeah, so it kind of felt like a really nice touch that that was really, really surprising and different. Okay, so now we've discussed the giraffe section, we'll take another little break, and then we'll come back and talk about the multiplayer. Okay, Sean, so I know you've been playing a lot of multiplayer yourself, and I've played a bit myself when I've found some time, and there's a relatively simple multiplayer suite to The Last of Us. There's only really two modes you can play, Supply Raid and Survival, and the gameplay in those modes is relatively similar, but what do you like about the multiplayer in The Last of Us, the multiplayer mode in The Last of Us?
I like the dynamic. Well, one, I like small multiplayer games. I like that it's 4v4.
Yeah.
But what I really like about The Last of Us is how methodical matches are in the game. I think they do a great job, especially in contrast to the Uncharted multiplayer bits. Like, the spawning is a lot better in this game than it was in either Uncharted game. Does a great job of keeping you with your team, which always encourages teamwork, and I more so than any other game that I've played, like, it is really difficult to lone wolf in The Last of Us. even if you get some of the boosters, I mean, it has boosters like Uncharted, which you unlock along the way, and you are allocated X amount of points to, you know, load out your character with weapons and boosters or whatever. But even with those boosters, it's It's a tall order, and you have to play extremely carefully if you want to lone wolf so that you can shiv people and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree. I found when I started multiplayer, I try and run off by myself. You're kind of in that mindset that you have if you've played most other third-person shooter multiplayers or even first-person shooter multiplayer games of late. But you really can't do that in this game. You definitely find that you will do better if you group together and you work together, because it's quite difficult to take people down, I would say. Well, it's not that difficult, but if you go out by yourself, you're very likely, because of how small most of the maps are, you're very likely to get set upon by an entire team, if you will. Well,
yeah, and the other thing is that I don't think it's difficult to take enemies down, but
no, yeah,
it does. Right. Once you down an enemy, they aren't dead. So and it creates this risk reward mechanic of, well, do I want to go in and get a special finisher, which earns you more, we'll say points, but they're called parts in the game, which is how you unlock boosters and other things like that. But you could just stay where you are and shoot them in their down state to finish them off, but you want to get in there and earn some more parts, or maybe you're working on a mission at the moment, which we'll get into in a little while. But
yeah, so it definitely sets up lots of risk-reward scenarios where you have to make the decision about whether you want to go in there and put yourself in more danger for more parts, as you say, or you want to hang back and just stay safe. So my favourite mode, there's only really two modes that you can play in multiplayer. My favourite mode is survival, because it's done in a series of rounds, and in each round you only have one life. You don't respawn in that round. So it's team versus team, and you have to kill every member of the other team. And I think the fact that you only have one life in each round really makes you more cautious about what you do in that round. And that made the games I played so far, that's made them feel tactical in a way that many other games, multiplayer games like this, don't feel tactical. They just feel like... they feel like just madness. Just they're not tactical. You're not thinking about what you're doing. You're just running in and shooting people because you know you'll respawn in a second. So I enjoyed that aspect of it.
Yeah, I hadn't played a game like that since Counter-Strike, basically. And I mean, Counter-Strike, you can lone wolf, but you do pay the price when you die because you could be waiting another 5 to 10 minutes while the match finishes itself off. But
I think there's something about that, the fact that you only have one life, that really changes the way you play. I've found that you see a lot of people being very cautious and hanging back and just listening to try and figure out where other people are. It's got a different feel to it. It feels a lot more considered than most multiplayer games these days.
Yeah, I find that, especially in Survivors, that I find that when I play Survivors that I want to stick with someone so that, one, I have backup, but two, like, since you can get into that down state, like, reviving characters is an incredibly important part of it. And the other thing that's really important is I think you have so much control in this game when you are in a down state. Like, Call of Duty have done the thing where you was it last chance or whatever, you can shoot the person before you bleed out or I don't know, whatever. But in The Last of Us, when you're downed, you still have a timer before your character bleeds out or whatever you want to call it. But it's really interesting the tactics that comes out of being downed when you can when you can crawl, because you can use that moment to be like, all right, I really want to, it's important for me to be revived, because if we're playing Survivors, if I die, we're only down to two players left on the team before the round ends. Or even in Supply Raid, like, if you have run out of spawns for the entire team, which is how that works, you have 20 spawns for the entire team.
Yeah.
Maybe it's more important to be revived. But if you're ahead, maybe it's more important to crawl into the most open place near you to draw your enemies out so that your teammates can kill them.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting.
That's an interesting point, because I think there's so many layers of tactics going on in these multiplayer games. and the fact that they've brought the crafting system over from the single player game into the multiplayer game really adds to that as well. So at the start of each match, everyone has a mad scramble to get to the nearest toolbox to pick up as many items as they possibly can. There are a number of toolboxes dotted around each of the maps, and literally the start of every multiplayer game is a mad dash to get to at least two of those toolboxes and craft something. Because you can craft Molotov cocktails, you can craft bombs, also health kits and ships. The same stuff that you can craft in the single player game. But if you manage to make a bomb, a Molotov cocktail, in the early instances of that game, that really gives you almost like a power weapon, if you will, as we were saying in the previous section. And that really gives you a tactical advantage in many situations.
Especially if when you get that upgraded melee weapon, when you get a 2x4 with some scissors on it.
Oh, yeah. That's it, really. That's a pretty decent weapon.
Yeah.
No bricks, though.
Yeah, there are no bricks. I think they would break multiplayer. Or at least I would break multiplayer with them.
Just be known as the brick man.
I think.
Yeah, so... Go on, sorry.
I was going to say, with the way that they dole out supplies, some people probably are not going to be fans of the way that the game kind of rubber bands almost.
Mm.
I find that
it feels like Mario Kart in that sense, where if you are last, so if you're the last person left in survival mode in one of the rounds on your team, if you find a toolbox and you open it up, you will get a hell of a lot of weapons. You'll get bombs and you'll get shivs and everything. So it really kind of gives you some kind of chance to fight off an entire enemy team. Or the remainder of the enemy team.
Actually, so it tries
to even block. I did as well, yeah. Because otherwise, if you don't have that, you're kind of stuck. That's it.
You are toast.
Yeah. So that really helps the balancing of games, I thought.
I think in Supply Raid, if you actually die a few times in a row without doing anything useful, they'll give you better item drops also.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess it doesn't bother me because I don't find myself dying. I mean, I'm generally don't get those kind of items doled out, so I don't feel like I'm breaking the game. But, like, it's almost kind of a way of, like, inverse balancing the multiplayer because it's already balanced in the way that Call of Duty multiplayer is, where you can, you know, if you've played, you've put in the hours, even if you're not that good, you're going to acquire better stuff than the other people around you.
So as you say, it works kind of like Call of Duty's multiplayer in the sense of the unlocks and the boosts that you can get if you play more, but there's also another layer to multiplayer in that there is kind of a meta game going on above all of the actions that you do in the individual games. So do you understand that very well, Sean? I've got to admit that I don't understand it too well at the moment, considering I'm only on week 4, but
yeah, I do understand.
Yeah, do you want to give a short explanation of how it works?
Sure. Okay, so the entire multiplayer suite, we'll call it, I guess, is called Factions. And when you first go into it, you choose a side, which honestly doesn't really mean a whole lot, but you can choose to be a hunter, which is basically the bandits of the single player that you fight for most of the game, or the Fireflies, which is, you know, the mythical resistance group that you're searching for basically the entire game. And that choice doesn't mean anything. All it really boils down to is the color of your character's clothes and whether or not they swear a lot when you're playing the game. I started the Hunters recently and they swear exponentially more, and my girlfriend was like, "What are these people saying?" I'm like, I'm playing as the bad guys now. It's okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, each and every match you play in multiplayer represents one day that your clan, quote unquote, has survived. You start out with 5 members, and you have kind of like this little, like, small radar with these blue dots on it that reminds me of the zombie infection simulator from way back in the day. And each match, based on your performance, You acquire parts from killing people. You acquire parts for reviving people. Anything you can do that's basically useful, like for crafting items, you get a little bit of, you get parts awarded to you. And the more and more parts you get are converted to supplies. And the more and more supplies you get determines whether your clan grows or shrinks.
Yeah.
So, and that's their interesting way of balancing it for good players and bad players. Like, if you're really good, you're always going to be getting more and more parts than you need, which means that your clan is going to grow and grow and grow. But
you can lose as well. You can go down from there. You can have good points and bad
if
points.
If you have a bad game, you get almost no parts, then a bunch of your clan's going to become hungry, and then they become sick, and then they're going to die. And as your clan members die off, it'll bring down the overall number of your clan, which means that you'll need to get less parts each game. So it's an interesting meta game because it always you want to grow your clan as much as you can. But
so what are the benefits of having a bigger clan then? You unlock more things?
You can unlock... I don't think there are any... I don't think there's any gear that's attached to clan size. I think that's only attached to parts. And I think they did that because that way players of all skill level will get those gear as long as they play at the time. Whereas you can get customization options for your character by getting like 100 people in your clan.
Right, okay. So it's purely cosmetic unlocks, if you will. Yeah, but that's some people are really into those types of meta games, and I think it's another layer of something different that they've added onto this multiplayer. It's not just standard deathmatch. There's actually lots of things to consider in multiplayer, and this meta game is one of them. It's quite an interesting meta game. So what's the highest number of people that you've had in your clan?
I think my max was 81 at one point.
81. God, that's super impressive.
Not apparently. I went on the leaderboards and there were people that had over 300 at some point.
God. Cool. Okay, then. Well, I haven't really been paying much attention to that side of things, I've got to say, but I think I've got about 60 people in my clan at the moment. Yeah.
That's okay, kind of where I averaged out most of the time, I would say.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so, definitely enjoying multiplayer. There's not that many options, not many different modes, but the modes are there, I think, are really well thought out and considered, and very enjoyable. I'm enjoying it. You're clearly enjoying it if you've played 12 weeks worth of matches.
More than that now since I've started the Hunter.
Yeah. Cool, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. Okay, so, is there anything else that you would like to discuss about The Last of Us, Sean, before we wrap up?
I'm curious what you think the single-player DLC is going to be.
Oh, single-player. I think it's going to be the game from the perspective of the giraffes. So you're going to start with that section where the giraffes meet up with Joel and Ellie. Joel pats them. And then you're going to go off and it's going to kind of be like Tokyo Jungle from then on. Playing as the giraffe.
So you think it'll primarily be a combat game since giraffes are excellent at
stealth.
Come on,
they've got maybe you play as the one giraffe that's learned how to use stealth. But yeah, they've got to build it on the same engine, so yeah, primarily be a combat game with giraffes. How Naughty Dog are going to get around the problem of having a giraffe hold a gun or carry a brick in its backpack, I'm not quite sure, but they've got some good animators there, so I'm sure they'll figure it out.
I'm interested in the canned clicker giraffe death animation, personally. Latching onto its leg. Pulling its trachea out of its knee.
that's a cool thing you could do. Clicker get underneath a giraffe, maybe, and do something? I don't know. Maybe you'll climb on it and ride it some more. But yeah, I think that'd be really cool. How about you? What do you think the DLC is going to be?
I really have no idea.
Yeah, God knows. Probably be some characters that you maybe came across. Maybe you'll play as Joel's brother. I could see that being it. Because he's an important character in the game, but you don't really see that much of him.
I'd really like it. I know it won't be, but what I would really like it to be is playing as Was it Henry and Sam?
Oh, yeah, Henry and Sam, yeah.
I'd really love to play as them before their group is separated.
I think that would be interesting. Yeah, see how they got to that situation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be an interesting and different dynamic to play as part of a big group of people who've come together and have they've built kind of like, I don't know, a civilization for themselves. Yeah, that would be something different. And I think with anything like this, the DLC, if you're going to have single player DLC, it needs to have a different perspective on the world from what you had in the main game. I think that's something really interesting they could do.
Yeah, I'm not sure where they can take Ellie and Joel's story, like, if they go earlier in the game, and I don't feel like they'll want to touch the ending, you know, it with, like, just a piece of standalone DLC. Maybe if they decide to go back and create a sequel that they can comment on that, but...
Yeah. No. Okay, then, that's it for episode 25. I think it's fair enough to say that we're both very impressed with The Last of Us as a game. Having a lot of fun with multiplayer, and the single-player game was super interesting and very well done. So if you want to let us know what you thought of The Last of Us, head on over to thunderboltgames.com and check out the forums, or alternatively, contact us on Twitter @_thunderbolt. Or email us at podcast@thunderboltgames.com. From me, it's goodbye. And from Sean...
So long.